Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast, where today we're doing the impossible job and predicting where the oil price might go. We're doing that with Bob Ryan, a senior vice president at BCA Research and one of the lone voices to be firmly bullish on the commodity for the past 12 months. And on that basis, we're taking his views extremely seriously for the months ahead. And so there were no shortage of alarm bells ringing when he said the following.
One of our trajectories for Brent goes above $120 a barrel by the end of next year.
Okay, so this was only one of a few possible scenarios, but for more details on how the oil price could breach $100, exploring the challenges in Iran, Venezuela, OPEC, and in US shale production, please keep listening. I might also suggest you have a pen and paper handy to note down some very useful production data. But before all of that, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Guthridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be looking at the energy markets, particularly in relation to the oil price. And on that basis, we're delighted to welcome back to the podcast Bob Ryan, the Senior Vice President on the Commodity and Energy Strategy and the Managing Editor on that service at BCA Research. One of the lone voices, I would say, certainly this time last year, speaking positively about where the oil price may go. And as so those who've listened to him have been greatly rewarded, perhaps not such a lone voice these days, but we'll get into that conversation. I think for our listeners' benefit, what we want to do is explore why Bob's view has come to fruition, you know, what was right, and then discuss some of the other variables, because there are so many variables, of course, in the oil price. As to what's contributed to perhaps the oil price even surpassing Bob's expectations this time last year. So on that point, Bob, I'll ask you to give us some sort of context as to what played out and why the oil price has arrived at where it is, why it's been so strong.
Happy to. And thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me here. Over the course of the past year, two things that stood out most were that demand was starting to look a lot stronger than most everybody thought. We started picking that up in the first half of the year, like, you know, in the first quarter even, when we started seeing EM import volumes picking up significantly. And through the second quarter, they took an almost vertical shot. And that's critically important because that is directly tied to income growth. When you see imports going up in EM, you know that that income is rising. So the World Bank estimates that the income elasticity of trade in EM, I think, is greater than one. So that means that as income goes up, 1% increase in income leads to an even larger increase in trade volume. On the import side. So we flagged that and we told our clients that, if this persists, we would be lifting our demand estimate. And it persisted, and we did. And we got way out on a limb. I think right around the time or shortly after we chatted last year, saying that demand would be much stronger than expected. And it's played out that way. So that was the one big piece of the puzzle. The other big piece of the puzzle was right around mid-year. So this is right when we met. And as you mentioned, everybody had turned bearish. I think that, the larger analyst community, the sell side banks, as well as the other, shops that do the research, we're seeing inventory globally, particularly in the OECD, continuing to build. And they took that to mean that the production discipline within OPEC 2.0, as we're calling it, which is this coalition led by the Saudis and the Russians, the larger part of the market took that as evidence that production discipline had broken down, and you know, these guys were back to cheating, and what else, you know, we told you to expect this. We, on the other hand, took them at their word that they would maintain production discipline, and we looked into it a little bit, and we saw that what essentially was going on was an inventory shift, you know, from the producing countries to the consuming countries. So inventory was still drawing, it was being transferred closer to refining centers. And, you know, that some of what we were seeing were just like, you know, little tiny blips on the production side from states that were having a very difficult time maintaining production, chief among those being Libya and Nigeria. So we took OPEC 2.0 at its word, largely because, you know, they had been taken to the brink of the abyss, as it were, in 2016, when prices collapsed. They went from over $100 in the middle of 2014 to down to close to $25 a barrel the early part of 2016, and everybody, you know, was confronted with the reality that their economies would collapse, and that mobilized and definitely focused the attention of everyone. So we stuck with that view, and that is how it played out. So here we are now. You know, we've had a very successful production agreement on the part of OPEC 2.0. They were successful in draining these inventories that had built considerably during the market share wars of 2014-2015. And demand has remained very strong. I mean, phenomenally strong. And, you know, the combination of those things, the draining of the inventory on the back of the strong demand and the production discipline on the supply side, lifted prices to where we are now. It also backwardated the curve, meaning that the front of the forward curve in the oil markets was trading above the deferred part of the forward curve. That's typically a sign that a market is tightening, and the more the curve backwardates, the tighter that curve is becoming. That's the market's way of letting you know that oil delivered today is worth more than oil delivered a year from now. You know, we're at the point now where this very strong demand growth, as well as some unintended production losses, particularly in Venezuela, which, you know, that the economy has just been run into the ground. The oil sector has been run into the ground. They are down to producing about 1 million barrels a day when, you know, at the end of 2016, before this production management deal, you know, the OPEC 2.0 deal kicked in, they were at over 2 million barrels a day. So they're down by a half in a very,
Bob,
very
short. If I could just interrupt, I mean, this supply side of the story is extremely fascinating, and it's obviously where all the geopolitics and the excitement lies. But if we could just tackle the demand side of the equation, if we can show our own discipline and tackle the demand side of the equation first of all, you seem very confident about demand, and certainly in relation to emerging markets, but not least at BCA Research, certainly in the investment community, there is this building concern, building narrative about a slowing China, not least within the industrial sector. So we certainly don't expect as much volatility out of the demand side as you do in the supply side, but perhaps the marginal, the relative to expectations at the margin, we may see disappointments on that side of the equation. I mean, how would you square up the demand levels?
That, you know, you raise very good points, and, you know, it is true that our EM strategists are concerned about the demand, overall GDP growth in EM. We don't yet see that coming through in the data. You know, the oil demand is still strong globally. We look at OECD and non-OECD. Non-OECD is our proxy for EM demand. We still see that as remaining strong. You know, historically up to this point, it's held up very well. It is the bulk of the demand that we see globally. Of the 1.7 million barrels a day of growth that we expect this year and next year, roughly like 1.3 million barrels a day of that 1.7 million barrels a day is coming from EM. So, you know, until we actually see evidence, like right now, there's a lot of fireworks, there's a lot of friction, there's, you know, there's a little smoke, but not a whole lot in the way of trade actually falling and collapsing. You know, the World Bank just issued its forecast for the near term, the next year or so. Last month, the middle of last month, they're expecting EM growth on the order of 5% per annum, you know, over the next year or so. You know, that's in line with what we expect. It's in line with what the IMF expects. And we're using those growth estimates to actually, drive the demand side in the models that we run to estimate forward demand. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, in America we call it agita. you know, there's a lot of angst about demand right now. And some of the forward-looking markets are, you know, saying things could slow, particularly EM equities, after, you know, a stunning run over the past couple of years. But so far in the real economy, it's just not showing up. You know, that downturn, you know, is not apparent in the data.
Okay, well, that's fascinating and you know, helpful for our own analysis because, yeah, we do sort of hear a lot of conversations about EM being vulnerable, but if it's not in the data, we must recognise that. Now, on the supply side, we'll get to this. We'll tackle that issue now because it is so fascinating. I think we want to look at Venezuela, as you just mentioned, but of course, Iran is a very hot topic, and how the US are responding to how the US sort of shale suppliers are responding to this elevated oil price. But first of all, a tiny bit of recent history. We've had OPEC 2.0, as you put it, up their supply. What is the rationale for that, and what did you get out of that meeting? Does it at all cloud or disturb your narrative about their discipline as a sort of a coalition?
What I got out of that meeting was the Saudis and the Russians are definitely in charge. They're definitely on the same page, and they are raising production to bring it in line with the original agreement to remove 1.8 million barrels a day from the market. If you look at what's actually been happening, you've had, you know, somewhere around 2.5, a little bit more million barrels a day removed from the market. 700,000 of which comes from the collapse in Venezuelan production, the on and off, mostly off Libyan contribution, and also Angola, you know, some of the, you know, the West African producers, you know, everybody outside of the Gulf Arab producers, everybody outside of that grouping within OPEC is actually losing production year on year. The only ones that are capable of increasing production are in the Gulf, led by the Saudis, and you have the UAE and Kuwait and Qatar in there. So they can raise production, and they've committed to raising production. You've seen Saudi last month took their production up from about 10 million barrels a day at the beginning of this year through, you know, January through May. It was actually slightly below 10 million a day. On the crude side, and they brought it up to 10.7 million barrels a day in June, and they have said they will bring it up to 11 million barrels a day this month, and more than likely will hold it there. You know, we write about that in the pub that we actually published today. We're looking to see how that plays out.
When you say you write about it in the pub, that's publication. That's just not you and your roughneck buddies.
No, the publication, yes.
Yeah, okay,
although
I've
become very fond of pub culture since we've moved to London.
Okay, great. Well, the pubs in the city may give you some insight actually into what's happening in the oil markets. But I guess the geopolitical story that is garnering a lot of attention at the moment is that Trump is really trying to, I guess, get Iranian's supply of oil into, you know, the OECD down to I guess zero. What are we seeing in terms of how the Iranian leadership are responding to Trump's initiatives, and do you have any insight into how the OECD are going to what level they may participate, and then I guess ultimately whether Trump will be arrive at his intended policy? And could this be a real massive blow to the supply side and, you know, really get the oil price firing? Or is some of that already in the price?
I think, you know, yes to everything that you said. I think that some of it is in the price. We've been modeling the loss of 500,000 barrels a day of Iranian exports. They're exporting something like 2.6 million barrels a day. They, you know, post the relief from the sanctions in 2015, they increased their production by a million barrels a day, roughly, from 2.8 to 3.8, which is where we are now. Our expectation was that, you know, it would take a while for the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. to bite, and we expect that, you know, we'll lose, and that occurs, that begins on November 4 of this year. We expect that, you know, this year we'll lose about 200,000 barrels a day from Iran, and then next year, first half, we'll lose another 300,000 barrels a day from Iran. So total 500,000 barrels a day, you know, lost from the Iran export side. Markets appear to be pricing, and you know, we're going to run this at, when we run our balances for this month's data. Markets appear to be pricing a larger number, like maybe a million, maybe even a little bit more lost from Iran. So that would be significant. We'll see. And in response to your earlier point about Trump saying he wants, you know, Iranian imports down to zero, you know, that did not sit long without a response. You know, the president of Iran, Rouhani, was saying just earlier this week that it makes no sense, I'm paraphrasing obviously, that, you know, the Arab Gulf countries would be able to export their crude out of the Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz when Iran can't. And this was a not so veiled threat to them shutting the Strait of Hormuz. You know, this revisits territory that the market has seen over the past few years. Prior to the lifting of the sanctions, this was threatened by Iran every now and then. The market would respond. It would put a risk premium into price. You know, it's something that the world takes very seriously. And I think I saw a headline yesterday where the U.S. Navy actually said it will do everything to keep the strait open. So, you know, you're setting yourself up for a potential conflict here as this brinkmanship escalates. You know, you have Trump saying, I'm demanding from our, you know, OECD brethren that they reduce their imports to zero. And Iran is saying, if we can't export, nobody exports. So we're in a stage of real brinkmanship right now that could have some very, we describe it today as chaotic effects on prices. These are this will be non-linear, like, you know, the response that the market has. I think the technical term is that, you know, these are exponential trajectories.
So. Well, I mean, it would be unfair of us to ask you, you know, how this is all going to play out. But I guess, I mean, you are in the game of, you know, calling the oil price. So I guess you've got to have a view. But if I sort of think about, I'm just trying to summarize before we get to the US response, but you expect some discipline out of the OPEC 2.0 production levels, but Venezuela could disappoint to the downside on production, and Iran is obviously an incredibly volatile story. I mean, does that sort of all add up to being something that's very supportive, but also something that's going to add volatility to oil price? Is there anything in there that that offers downside risk to the oil price? I mean, is that really supportive for upside surprises to the oil price?
Upside surprises near term, downside surprises beyond that. And the reason for that is you could see the collapse of Venezuela removing a million barrels a day of exports from the market. If the market is right and we get a million or more barrels per day lost from Iran, you're looking at just those two events alone, you know, over in a very short period of time, depending on how it evolves, you've lost 2 million barrels a day of exports on the global market. OPEC spare capacity is estimated by the U.S. Energy Information Administration at 1.8 million barrels a day right now. So right there, those two extreme events would exceed the spare capacity of OPEC to respond to, you know, and this is higher cost production. This is production that it takes 90 days to bring on. You cannot sustain it indefinitely. And, it's expensive to do that. You've got other things going on. Libya just declared force majeures. That civil unrest there is not, leaving the market anytime soon. That affected 825,000 barrels a day. These are, volumes that in a 100 million barrel a day market, of demand seem trivial. But, the important point is that these are highly inelastic commodities, so that when you get a shock to the supply side, the only thing that can adjust in the near term is price. Demand does not adjust. So you lose supply at the margin. You do lose 2 million just for the heck of it. You could be over $120 a barrel, at some point next year on the back of that, if you lose 1 million from Iran and if you lose 1 million from Venezuela. In our modeling, we're still assuming 500,000 barrels a day out of Iran. And even in that world, one of our trajectories for Brent goes above $120 a barrel by the end of next year. So, you're in a world where, and that's why, this amping up of the rhetoric in this world, this is already tight. This is before you even consider the Strait of Hormuz being shut. This is even before you have confrontations, between the U.S. and its allies and the Iranians and their allies in the Gulf or in the rest of the Middle East. So that's what the market is starting to internalize, and that's what the market is starting to reflect in price. We had a rally this week, earlier in the week, even with Saudi saying that they were going to be increasing production to 11 million barrels a day. If you go through the arithmetic the way we did, the market remains in deficit this year, the second half of this year, even with the increases from the states in OPEC 2.0 that can increase production. We estimate they'll be able to increase production, or they will increase production, something like 800,000 barrels a day in the second half of this year. But the non-Gulf producers are still losing production. So the net this year is only going to be something like 275 to 300,000 barrels a day of new production coming to market. Next year, depending on what we see, you could still see a net, decline in volumes available to the market, even with the core OPEC and Russia, increasing their production.
Well, so, I mean, it's fascinating that we haven't yet talked about the OECD supply, and particularly obviously the US shale supply. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that strategists across the board were saying, well, the oil price is capped to the upside now because, US shale supply can be turned on so quickly. And so, I mean, what is your take on the response we're seeing across the Atlantic? Has it turned out to be the case that these things can be turned back on as easily as was so wisely forecast by the investment community?
Very good point. The shale guys have been enormously successful. We reckon they're going to grow their production this year about 1.3 million barrels a day, and next year by another 1.3, 1.35 million barrels a day. So at the end of this year, they're close to, 6.7, 6.8 million barrels a day of production. And at the end of next year, they're closer to 8 million barrels a day on average. The problem is they're too successful in what they're doing. They're increasing production particularly in the Permian Basin, at a rate that exceeds the capacity of the system to get the stuff out into the market. So they don't have enough pipeline takeaway capacity in the Permian. They're producing more than 3 million barrels a day just in that basin, and they don't have sufficient treatment and pipelines to get it down to the refining centers or down to ports where they can export it. U.S. exports of crude oil have been surging. You know, it's up at about 3 million barrels a day most recently. All of this, you know, if you look at the shales in 2007, for all intents and purposes, they were zero. If you look at U.S. exports, for all intents and purposes, by law, they were zero until 2015. Or the end of 2015, I believe, when the law was changed to allow the export of crude oil. So you're seeing production, you know, on its way to 10 million barrels a day in the shales, and exports could easily go to 5 million barrels a day, you know, by the, you know, the early 2020s out of the U.S. You put that on top of the 4.5-5 million barrels a day of refined products that gets exported out of the U.S. The U.S. now becomes the dominant crude oil producer and one of the probably the dominant crude and product exporter in the world. In the very near term, they've got more capacity to produce than they have capacity to move that production. So what's happening is that you know, you're actually slowing the rate of growth, and you may be forcing some production to close in until these pipelines are built. In the Permian.
Okay. So I guess if we get to the final point, I know you've already revealed some guide as to where Brent could go. But I mean, again, if I reiterate that there does seem some vulnerabilities to downside surprises in supply from OPEC and the US shale producers, whilst they can produce the oil, can't get it to market. That leaves the market being pretty tight. So, you know, do you, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, trying to summarize what you've been saying and therefore ask you to offer us some sort of range as where the oil price may go as we head towards the into the second half of the year. And then, you know, do you have a more of a medium term forecast, like for an average price for 2019 as well?
Sure. So right now, Brent is trading at about $78 a barrel, and WTI is trading at about $74 a barrel. This is roughly in line with where we, you know, where our model, our modeling suggests they should be trading. The Brent price right now, my belief is, reflects this risk premium that's into the pricing structure. You know, our supply-demand model suggests that Brent should average about $70 a barrel over the second half of this year. And we're assuming that the OPEC 2.0 production increases that they agreed to are going to be front loaded into the second half of this year. So that's the reason we took it down from, I think we were at 76 was our expectation last month. That was before we knew what the production increase out of OPEC 2.0 was going to look like. You know, $8 seems like a lot of risk premium. If you just look further out the curve, you know, that curve is backwardated. So if you were to look at the average price of Brent versus what our average expectation is, it's probably reflecting something more like $4 or $5 a barrel of risk premium in Brent right now as a result of all this geopolitical tension that we've been talking about. Next year, our expectation for Brent is $77 a barrel. Again, that reflects the front loading of, you know, the increases this year and additional increases next year and still pretty strong demand, plus all the other stuff that's at work underneath the surface, you know, the Iran sanctions, the continued loss of Venezuelan production, all of that gets, you know, figured into our estimate. So that's at 77. When we do our scenario, we use an ensemble to generate forecasts. Now, when we do the scenarios where you lose another million barrels a day of Venezuelan exports, and you know we take off 500,000 barrels a day of Iranian exports, and you continue to see bottlenecks in the U.S. shales that are keeping as much of that crude that could get to market from getting to market, we are on a trajectory that takes us above $120 a barrel by the end of next year. So, you know, we're in a period of time right now where it's very difficult to forecast. Again, it's these things that have the potential to become chaotic that make it difficult to forecast. But over the next 18 months, the risks are to the upside. If you do see $120 crude or $150 crude, you know, next year, you will see a very strong response on the demand side. You know, when oil prices collapsed as a result of the 2014 market share wars, a lot of EM countries in particular either removed or modified fuel subsidies. And now consumers there are much more directly exposed to higher prices, and they will, their behavior will adjust very quickly if we start moving toward 120 bucks.
Okay, well, thank you, Bob. I mean, you're certainly in the impossible job trying to forecast where the oil price is going. But you've done an excellent job to date, certainly in our experience, and you've teed up nicely what may lie ahead. I guess some it wouldn't surprise you if we're in this sort of $70 to $80 sort of range, but the risks are to the upside, it seems. So thanks very much for sharing your thoughts, and we welcome you. We'd love to have you back in the future to scrutinize whether you're getting it, you're still getting it right. So thanks very much, Bob. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. Leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening. Thank you.